Self Surprise Podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Carrie Gillen.
And I'm Megan Figueroa. And here we are. Here we are.
It's fall.
It creeped up on us. Well, here. Maybe not in Vancouver. Maybe you knew it was coming.
Oh, yeah. No, it's been kind of fallish for a while now, thankfully. I've never been so grateful for it to be fall.
Yeah, since it was so hot there.
It was way too hot for a few periods. Particularly in June, it was terrible. Terrifying, in fact.
Yeah. Just like our monsoons were kind of a couple of them. Two of them are pretty terrifying.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're always kind of scary, especially if they're right overhead, but...
No, this was like, should we get into the tub? Scary.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. It was horrifying. Our shed flew away.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about the shed. The wandering
the shed.
The shed,
yes.
I also, I realized we waited another month for this episode to come out, and I think maybe we should just admit to ourselves that once a month is what we're capable of. Once again.
Yes. Yeah, I know. I mean, what is even capacity? I'm like, what is that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Everything just feels like, it feels very delicate. Everything just feels very delicate. Like, one wrong thing could happen and, like, everything's going to fall apart. And that's probably always been true, but it just, like, really feels that way right now.
Oh, yeah. The cascading effect feels, like, more true these days.
Yes.
The negative cascading effect. Not something leading to something good and then even more good and some more good. That's not happening.
Yeah. I'm sure people who understand, like, how networks work could explain why that's actually probably true, that like a cascading effect leads to negative effects rather than good.
I mean 10 years from now they're gonna be teaching this era in textbooks as like a dark era, so I mean
definitely a bunch of things will be in the textbook. Oh, well, if it's an honest textbook.
Yes, of course. Which is
which is not a guarantee.
No,
especially in the US and especially right now.
But. Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, I thought, since it is, maybe by the time this comes out, no longer, but it is the International Week of Deaf People 2021. One of my mutuals on Twitter, and I apologize in advance if I pronounce this incorrectly, because I haven't heard it, only seen it written, Opayemi A, he tweeted, "Deaf rights to language, expression, literacy, and education have been marginalized throughout history, and sign languages have taken second place to spoken languages," while he also tweeted, "The genocide of sign languages, protecting the linguistic rights of Africa's deaf children."
I've been thinking about this a lot lately, just with some articles that I've been writing, and even thinking about podcasting, too. Our friend of the pod, Dr. John Hemner, he mentioned that even transcripts of podcasts aren't the same as having access to a podcast, because it flattens out the dynamic between the co-hosts.
Yes.
And so it's like there's so many ways that, okay, we think that podcasting, which I love, is, you know, makes science more accessible to other people, more people, and that's true, but it's not the most accessible medium there is.
Well, I'm not sure if there is such a thing as a most accessible. There are differing types of accessibility.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I was listening to 20,000 Hertz yesterday, and the episode was about described video. There was this blind man on who was talking about his experience watching TV growing up and how things changed because suddenly there were some descriptions for some things and how some companies do a better job than others, and it's just really fascinating. Yeah. So there's no one perfect way.
No, you're right. Because there are different ways that a person might need access to things.
And
I mean, as simple as that. Yeah.
You can't do it in all languages. So you're never going to be fully accessible to everybody.
It's true. So
we just have to be better, not perfect. That's what I think.
Yes. And constantly thinking about how we can be better.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And I was just thinking about how so many just wildly, wildly popular podcasts do not even
try
to have transcripts at all.
Because they really have to.
Loads and loads of money. Loads of money.
Yeah.
And don't even try. Yeah.
Yeah, but they don't feel like they have to because they're so popular. Like, they just, there's no, nothing really putting pressure on them to even attempt. Because right. they already have enough people listening. They're fine. Yep. In their heads.
In their heads, yeah. I'm like, what a terrible way to reason.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah, oh, I know you do. I know, just... absolutely.
So, I yeah, know. So this article is about, you know, and I know the history is more complicated than this, but I don't know the full story, so whatever. So the mm-hmm. 1880 Milan Convention basically convinced a lot of people that deaf kids should only speak language, use oral language rather than sign.
Oralism, right?
Yeah, oralism.
Wait, 1800s?
1880.
Wow.
Yeah. And I know, again, it had differing effects on differing populations. So mm-hmm. I can't remember who was tweeting about this like a few weeks ago, but and so I apologize. But in the United States, white kids were forced to use oral language, but black kids weren't.
Huh.
So yeah, it wasn't like this blanket thing that worked across yeah. the world. But this decision still did have effects that rippled across the world, and it continues to be felt today.
I can only imagine it's a racist reason, right?
Yes. Yeah, they just didn't think that the black kids were, like, going to do that well, so it didn't matter if they got the oral language or not.
And, like, they're like, these white kids are going to make something of themselves. We better make sure they, you know.
They at least have the potential. Yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah. My God. Yeah.
So this article is more about how, actually, even within sign languages, there's, like, differing levels of prestige, basically. So there's developed sign language in quotation marks and under or less developed sign languages. And so the developed sign languages are used for wider scientific discourse and are better studied, and the under or less developed ones are understudied and only used more conversation or, well, you know, more interpersonally, I guess I should say.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a dominant sign language that can still marginalize other sign languages. And it's just like, it just shows that all these hierarchies are working all at the same time, and we can't lose sight of this intersectionality, I guess.
Well, yeah, in America we have ASL, but then we also have BASL, Black American Sign Language. I bet you can guess where the where they stand in the hierarchy. And I've actually, there's been some TikTok stars, at least one, and I'm
Deaf Hottie.
Yes. You know, she was in the New York Times talking about Black American Sign Language. So, like, there has been some, at least a little bit more of the acknowledgement that, you know, these things exist. And I get, you know, TikTok, it has its good in the world.
Oh, no, I'm mostly pro-TikTok. I know that there's some problems and some bad actors on there, but I enjoy it.
Yeah.
Another thing that this talks about is that, you know, the indigenous sign languages in Africa, most if not all of them, are marginalized, dominated, and suppressed by foreign sign languages. So ASL and BSL, which is British Sign Language, etc. There are lots of smaller sign languages that don't get any attention, and they are potentially going to be suppressed to the point where no one uses them anymore.
Right. I mean, it's a good thing to think about, like, kind of how the same, where we're trying to, you know, be cognizant of what the indigenous languages are around us, where we are. Perhaps, you know, checking out and see what the deaf communities use around you. It might not be ASL if you're in the U.S. It might be some minoritized sign language.
And in Canada, there's at least three. Well, no, sorry,
Quebec,
four.
Quebec has a different one, right?
It's complicated, but yes, most of Quebec. People who are in a Francophone community are going to use the French one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's an Inuit one. And then there's also a maritime one.
Oh.
The maritime one is very understudied.
Wow. Interesting. Cool. And then there's the what's the fourth one? The
ASL.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm being a U.S. American right now and assuming that American means only North, the U.S. and not Canada.
Well, I mean, so the naming convention is kind of like, where did it develop? And it did develop in the United States.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, we should talk about the word America at some point and how annoyed I am that everyone wants Canada to be America. And I'm like, no, it's not.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, we should. But yeah, get away from us as far as you can, metaphorically.
Yeah. But yeah, so I just thought this was a really interesting article, and I'll put it in the show notes. And just like all of us should think about, just there's so much more out there than even what we know about. I didn't know. I mean, according to this article, there's like 300 sign languages around the world. I knew there were lots, but I didn't know that number.
And I realize I really don't know what's happening in Mexico in terms of sign languages. And I'm like, what, 90 miles away from Mexico, you know? So.
Yep. Are you even that far away?
Yeah, I was going to say 90 minutes. And I'm like, 90 miles? Is it really that far? No, it's not that far. I think it's about 60 miles. Okay, Tucson to Nogales is 66.4 miles, 1 hour.
Okay, so so 66. Okay.
Yeah.
Our episode today is about BTK. Oh, sorry. It's actually about K-pop and not serial killers.
Yes. Yeah, but you can listen to BTS because they are a K-pop group.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah.
I admit that I have not yet listened to K-pop and gotten into it, but now I'm going to have to.
I still haven't listened to it. I think I've, like, heard snippets on, like, to Twitter or something, but I haven't really gone out of my way, and I really should. I know that our guest talks about that there's, like, from every genre you can possibly think of,
it's called K-pop. Exactly.
So the pop part is not really what we think of as pop in North America. Right. It's more just popular. And from Korea.
Exactly. It doesn't have to sound like NSYNC or Backstreet Boys, no.
Or Britney or any of those.
No. Yeah, exactly.
But it can. And they do.
It can.
Some of them.
And that's cool.
Yeah.
But, yeah. All right. We hope you enjoy.
Like this show and want to make your own? Let me tell you about Anchor. It's free, and they have creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And now you can even add any song from Spotify directly to your episodes. The possibilities are endless for what you can create, whether it's music analysis, your own radio show, or something the world's never heard before. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. And you can also make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
Hey, Carrie and Megan, it's Stephanie Zelenkevich. I am kicking myself because I didn't realize that there was this send the vocal fries a message link in your show notes. So sorry. And then I also was having problems trying to attach the video of me saying my name. So instead of seeing my pandemic, exhausted, non-makeuped mom face, maybe you'll be able to hear this. And so, like I said, I love the show. You guys are great. I love all the swearing. Keep it up. As another woman who swears a lot, I moved from New Jersey, South Jersey, so the nice Philly accent, down to Georgia, and I get a lot of crap for swearing, so I love it. So anyway, Stephanie Zelenkevich, you guys are awesome. Thanks. Bye.
Hi, so today, do I ever say hi, Carrie?
No, but that's fine.
Hi.
You can start however you want.
Hi, everyone. I really excited because we have a newly minted PhD with us today. We have Dr. Joyhana Ugarza, who is a sociocultural linguist who is currently a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Anthropology at Harvard University. Her work examines the role of language, affect, and the body in mediating flows of popular culture online, transversing the fields of linguistics, semiotics, anthropology, Asian American studies, and feminist studies. Her secondary research area examines the racialization of Asian American students on college campuses. Hi, Joy. We're so happy to have you.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Hi, Carrie. So nice to be with you all. I feel like a cool kid.
It's funny because when I think of doing this, I think of being the nerdy kid.
Well, of course, we're all nerds. There's levels to it, yes.
We're going to start with a question that really haunts both Carrie and I. What the heck is semiotics and why can't I ever remember what it means? You don't have to answer that last part. It's not on
no,
you.
No, this is like a yeah, why can't you remember it again? Yeah, I'm not here to shame anyone. You know, so semiotics is hard to remember, I think in part because, like, honestly, as linguists, we're not really, there's not a whole lot of training, I would say, in semiotic analysis in a lot of linguistics programs. But, you know, semiotics, I really want to do it justice here, but I would say most broadly, it's just like the study of signs and sign processes, right? And by signs, of course, I mean like anything that communicates meaning. And as linguists, of course, like we're trained to look at linguistic signs, but semiotics, crucially for like my purposes, goes beyond just like linguistic form. And I feel like the most maybe robust uptake of semiotics has been really with linguistic anthropologists, right? I'm thinking about, you know, like Roman Jakobson and his student, the late Michael Silverstein, who really gravitated towards this like Persian tradition, right? Theorization of signs. And they were looking at language and going like, there's so much more here than just linguistic form and like referential semantics. There's also this obviously poetic side to language. And so they really theorize what we know today as like indexicality and indexical functions of language, and really paying attention to specific like sociocultural dimensions of language use.
Can you explain indexicality? Just because I don't think all of our listeners will know.
Oh, that's a good one. So I will say like maybe the canonical example that's used to describe this is that, you know, when you look at, say, smoke, right? Smoke is indexical of fire, right? So when we think of that in terms of like indexical relations, like, you know, like someone might say, oh, I don't know, like, let's take greetings, for instance, right? You might say like, hey, you might say, what's up? You might say, hello. And all of those things arguably have like a similar function, but they say very different things about those speakers, right? Depending on the social context. So that's what indexicality really gets at.
Cappuccino, Simpson? Ahoy, ahoy? No, you have the wrong number. This is 5246. I suspect you need more practice working your telephone machine. Not at all. Ahoy.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Carrie. I feel like I'm taking my comps again.
That's what this is, a very informal comps.
So a sign, as a linguist might think of it, could be like a word, right?
Yeah. Oh, precisely.
So like dog, and it signifies the fluffy four-legged domestic, right?
Is that exactly? Okay. Exactly. No, but crucially, right, like depending on even your relationship to dogs, you could have a very different dog in your head. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So okay. it brings into question, right? So all of the different dimensions of language, like who's doing the interpreting, for instance, right?
Oh, so if I'm love dogs, I think of something lovely about dog, like that's semiotically created in my head then?
I would say attachment? Like, right. For instance, like, oh, I don't know, like as someone that didn't grow up with dogs myself, I might think of like a popular culture dog, right? Like Lassie or something. And you might think of your dog that you grew up with. I don't know, right? I'm just thinking like of an example. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But crucially for the point that I'm trying to make about semiotics, I think
the sort of social orientation to the sign matters, right, for its interpretation.
Oh, yes, I get it. Okay. And so this can really play into, like, overt and covert forms of, like, linguistic racism and...
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes, and, absolutely. Okay. We see this a lot, like, in you know, media cycles, right, where people will feign ignorance because they say, oh, I'm not trying to say that. But when we dig deeper and we look at maybe the histories of language or the social functions of language, we know we can kind of uncover these covert meanings of language mm-hmm. that, in fact, are often, you know, like, problematic or whatever.
Can you give us an example?
Ooh, that's a great, let me think off the cuff. I actually think a really good example right now is critical race theory. Right? You know, okay. There's sort of this whole backlash against critical race theory by critics who really don't even know the history of critical race theory, what it is, what theorists are all involved, the history of it, right? And I really think critical race theory is actually a proxy for racialized epistemologies, right? Epistemologies from a tradition of minoritized peoples. So I think that when we invoke something like critical race theory, in fact, we're talking about, like, these marginalized knowledges and histories. But people won't say that. And when you sort of put them to task, they might feign ignorance, like, oh, I'm not talking about that. When in fact, okay, when we look at sort of how you're using language to dismiss critical race theory, there's an argument to be made.
That's a really good example and really salient right now.
Yes.
Probably for most of our listeners.
Okay, so let's talk about K-pop, because that's what you really wanted to have you on for. So can you, first of all, explain K-pop to people who might not have heard of it at all? And, you know, just a little bit of its history would be helpful, too.
Sure. Yeah. So K-pop, of course, like, stands for Korean pop. And it's sort of this catch-all term for all popular music coming out of South Korea. I would say much to the dismay of some artists, right, who don't want to be associated with K-pop. But crucially, I would say, you know, K-pop is much more than just music per se, like a musical genre. It's considered oftentimes by scholars to be a multimedia text, which means that there is like the visual component is just as important, if not more important, than the actual music, right? And there's a historical reason for this. K-pop has, you know, existed since the early 90s, but you don't really see this explosion until the late 2000s into the 2010s. And there's a clear reason for this, right? It's the advent of YouTube. So K-pop really explodes with the accessibility afforded by YouTube. And in terms of K-pop history, K-pop in South Korea is often attributed to this one band, Seotaejin Boys. And they were this, like, unmistakably hip-hop group, you know, like, they were using samples and styles that were based in the US, you know, like, identifiably American. And their lyrics, though, importantly, addressed really specific issues in South Korea at the time. So, you know, their lyrics, there was a lot of social critique, you know, teenage angst, a lot of, like, uncertainty of the future. And that was, you know, that's a direct sort of product of the precarity of young people at the time, right? Because of the, like, rapid industrialization of South Korea of the 70s and 80s. So beyond Seotaejin's sort of, you know, explosive moment in the early 90s, I would say that Black music and the influence of Black music has had a very long history in South Korea, dating back to U.S. militarization of the Korean Peninsula, like, in the 40s and 50s, right? So I think that, you know, K-pop is really interesting because there are so many players, right, actors, there's producers, you know, artists and songwriters, many of whom are actually not Korean and not based in Korea. So even the extent to which K-pop is considered, you know, quote unquote, truly purely Korean is really contested, I would say, in the literature.
So does that actually then lend itself to its global popularity?
Right. I mean, even your question, Carrie, like, who doesn't know about K-pop, right? It is, I think the global reach is so like palpable in recent years. And I would say that, you know, like even fandoms, right, like have a really interesting history in South Korea. Like they have been, you know, there have been fandoms, really vibrant fandoms of K-pop since the early 90s. There's actually an ethnomusicologist from Santa Barbara. Her name's Stephanie Choi. She has this excellent dissertation about female fandoms in South Korea. And she talks specifically about, I actually think she uses the word fanhood as a way of like ascribing a little bit more agency to fans. But I would say fan culture of K-pop globally, like there's such a really vibrant literature on that. And, you know, like, I think, I don't know if either of you are fans or like know much about K-pop history, but in the US, I think the BTS's like first live performance on the Billboard Music Awards, which was I think in like 2017 or 18, that was kind of like a watershed moment for K-pop in the US. You know, like it not only marked this crossover into the American market, which is like notoriously hard for K-pop artists, but I also think it showed non-K-pop fans like the enormity of K-pop fandom. You know, you saw like these fans crying on camera, or they were like dancing every single move of the choreography to the T. So yeah, I think that
sounds affirming in some ways as a fan.
I mean, yeah, right, exactly. Because I think that fan culture, it's not just sort of this unilateral like consumerism or consumption of the media. Fans really drive K-pop. Like there's a real demand, and fans really drive content as well. So I think that, not to jump the gun, but I think that is what kind of lends K-pop a little bit to appropriation as well, because it's so driven by these fan demands and expectations.
Why is it so notoriously difficult for K-pop to break through in the US?
So I will say that some K-pop artists have done really major collaborations with American artists, like dating back to the 90s, right? Mm-hmm. So like there's this K-pop artist named Rain who did a collaboration with Usher like back in the 90s or early 2000s. There have been a number, like the artist that I study in my paper, she's done a number of really visible collaborations with US artists and producers, right? And DJs. Mm-hmm. So it's not that these crossovers or collaborations are not happening. I would just say that BTS sort of represented like a major crossover that I don't think was as visible, right? Mm-hmm. Like there were definite crossovers before, but not to this extent, I would say.
Okay, so let's talk about it. So we can talk about cultural appropriation. Like, what is it and how does it manifest in this K-pop milieu?
Yeah, this is a really big question, you know, the question of cultural appropriation. And I don't pretend to be like the expert on cultural appropriation. I think that, you know, some folks might define it as a kind of theft, you know, others might define it in terms of injury, you know, like does the injured party have more or less social power, right? Mm-hmm. I guess some of these definitions are not entirely satisfactory to me. I think oftentimes because they depend on really overdetermined ideas of culture and power, right? Because power can be contested, right? And culture is sort of unstable, so, and always in flux. So, you know, as I kind of write overtly in the paper, like I'm not actually interested in, is this appropriation or not, just for the sake of like condemning a single artist. I'm really much more interested in why appropriation is happening at this like larger scale, right? Like it's so pervasive in K-pop. And then what's the history of this? And then what are its effects in the present day? I'm always really inspired by Bell Hooks' essay, Eating the Other, where she talks about the commodification of difference, right? And she calls this consumer cannibalism, right? And I think that picture of consumption is so appropriate and vivid, because she talks about this desire to consume a racialized other, but in a way that really bolsters your oneself and doesn't actually do much to contest power, right? In the case of K-pop specifically, I don't think appropriation is a secret. You know what I mean? I don't think it's even really controversial to say that appropriation is a common practice in K-pop. So as I wrote in the paper, it's not really a matter of if appropriation is happening, but rather how and to what effect. So that's kind of my interest, my overt interest. Yeah.
And then how does, so we talked about K-pop being a multimedia experience. What are some of the aesthetics that appear in K-pop performances?
Yeah. So, K-pop is really known for its explosive, almost sensorial experience, right? So you really have oftentimes a mix and mixing and matching of styles that are sometimes hard to locate. What is this just explosion of color and lights and style? So I think K-pop really takes the visual components, not just of bodily adornment or clothing, things like that, but the set, right? How is this presented in a video? It's not, it's common knowledge that K-pop singles and videos are often dropped on the same day, whereas in the past we used to see musical singles coming out before, right? So that's not the case oftentimes with K-pop. They're meticulously timed to be released at the same time. Again, bolstering this idea that the visual component is just as important. And beyond that, I think the popularity of K-pop dance, right? And there's a whole phenomenon of dance cover. I think that really attests to the importance of the visual dance component as well.
Now I'm really wanting to watch some videos of this. Have they moved from YouTube to TikTok?
Or I'm actually not on TikTok, so I can't say with sort of confidence. I would say that I think YouTube still dominates, because it's that long. Are certainly, I've seen snippets of K-pop music or, choruses being recycled on TikTok, but I still think YouTube is where K-pop lives.
Yeah, you can't do whole songs on TikTok, right. Yeah. So it's got a different function.
There's also the intertextual component, right? I'm not on TikTok, but I would not be surprised if there were sort of teasers happening on TikTok, right? Because there certainly are on, there's a ton on Instagram, right? So that sort of porousness between these different media platforms is certainly a big strategy of these K-pop companies now.
So can you explain the ways that cultural appropriation show up in K-pop? What are they doing, or what are they taking, or what are people taking from them? How's this working?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's in any straightforward way. I don't think it's in any sort of unidirectional way. Mm-hmm. But I think that, because K-pop as an industry is quite well known to be pretty cutthroat, right? That's pretty euphemistic, I would say. And K-pop artists, even some of the most well-known K-pop artists, really only have a public life, sort of life in the limelight, of an average of 5 to 8 years, right? So they really have to figure out ways to constantly be new and constantly be trendy, which is why I think appropriation is so pervasive, because you see something on YouTube or you see something on Instagram and you see what's trendy, and it's a craft, right, for the K-pop industry. They've really mastered how to identify trends and what's going to sell. So ultimately it's a commodification machine, right? So I think that's in part what sort of
what is kind of causing these practices more broadly, which of course I also want to emphasize per your question, Carrie, this is not unique to K-pop, of course. Like, no. I think this is in many ways like a product of globalization, but it is, I think, because K-pop has this sort of like newer emergence and hegemony in the realm of popular culture, it's like very noticeable, right?
Not to like, I mean, I'm a fan of very many dumbs, so I've been very many fandoms, but just thinking about how we consume these things, it's really like not struggling, but like going through some of like what I do listening to you.
Yeah. And to be fair, like I think K-pop, like popular music broadly, is made to sound good. Like it's not a secret that we listen to this and we're like, wow, that is really catchy. Like I don't understand anything that's happening, but there is something about it that's just like really like it lends itself to repetition, right? And that's very purposeful, right? That's not just us sort of suddenly becoming like a K-pop stan. Like these songs are really designed and engineered to be the most catchy, right?
Yeah. I mean, how else are you going to get like a million fans?
Exactly.
You said that producers and songwriters often are not even Korean. Do you think that that is lending itself then to some of the, you know, maybe linguistic appropriation or style aesthetic?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's no secret, I think, that U.S. Black American cultural production broadly, but certainly in the realm of music, has been appropriated like in so many global contexts. And so, of course, like I do think the involvement of these sort of multinational producers definitely play into that. I will say in the context of some of the, you know, most visible, famous, well-known producers in the Korean context are actually Korean American and have spent time in the U.S., have been hip-hop artists themselves. Mm-hmm. So they're tapping into these globalized networks as well. They're not just sort of, there's really no such thing as these like geographical boundaries that are like keeping them from not appropriating, right?
So can you tell us about some linguistic examples? And I'm referencing specifically here your paper on the whole bad bitch vibe in K-pop.
Yeah, I'd love to. So I really want to shout out this group of linguists who did this fantastic 2013 survey. It was Moon, Lee, and Star. And they did this like quantitative analysis of phonological variation in English and Korean among two well-known K-pop bands. Mm-hmm. And they found that the members used a lot of what they called anglicized Korean, which was heavily influenced by African-American English, right? Mm-hmm. So unsurprisingly, the rappers, right, the rapping members of these two bands had higher rates of eye monophthongization and uses of what they called anglicized Korean. Mm. So in my paper, I talk about two AAE features, zero copula and monophthongization, but also like crucially generic features of hip hop, like call and response and the performance of braggadocio, which is taking on this persona of like, I am the best, I am the richest, or I am the most attractive, or whatever, right? But performing this kind of braggadocio. And like what I tried to highlight in the paper was that, yes, there's appropriation of these linguistic features happening, but it's not just the linguistic features in and of themselves that matter, but rather like these other semiotic features, right? And so I spend a lot of time analyzing embodied actions that also contribute to this bad bitch persona. Mm-hmm. And also if I had only focused on the linguistic form, it would really not have done justice to the multimedia text, as I mentioned, that is K-pop, right? You really have to also analyze like the visual component. I think that what I argued was that at least for Korean femininity, like one could interpret this as like a particularly agentive kind of femininity
if not like pretty individualistic and classist, right? But I think the broader point I'm trying to make is that if I had studied like just the linguistic form, I don't know that I would have been able to make the claims that I made in any sort of convincing sense, right? Without the other semiotic features.
And some of those other semiotic features might be, for example, dressing in the whole so-called Chola aesthetic, or perhaps be girl style, right? So having like body adornments you put on your body that contributes to this multimedia experience is perhaps associated with, you know, the Chola aesthetic is like very Los Angeles, Chicana.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, there's actually a vibrant literature on Chola appropriations by U.S. white artists, right? White femme artists, right? Thinking like
of Lana Del Rey.
Madonna. Yeah, truly. Yeah, Lana Del Rey, you know, Gwen Stefani, et cetera, et cetera. And the list really goes on. But I think what happens in K-pop oftentimes is these styles get sort of chopped up, right? Mm-hmm. Like there, you see sort of the hoop earrings here, and then you mm-hmm. see like a particular kind of makeup style here, or you might see like the long nails over there, but they're often these disembodied styles. And so what I tried to do in the paper was go like, actually these styles have historical sort of a historical emergence that we can look at and track and see how K-pop as an industry kind of sutures them together to create this other sort of, this new sort of femininity.
And so importantly, they're coexisting with the linguistic forms.
Exactly, exactly.
Which I think is a very important thing for us linguists to remember who didn't focus on like socio or anthropological linguistics, because so many people, so many linguists have the problem of forgetting that there is a human behind the language and what all of that contributes to the language and how it might show up on any given day or any given hour of any given day.
I mean, embodiment in general, I think in linguistics is sort of sorely understudied. And that makes sense in a lot of ways in terms of like the way that the focus that we have as linguists. But I think remembering that there is sort of the specific sociocultural context in mm-hmm. which, you know, language is produced is really important. But also I think what I find really encouraging is like there is sort of this really vibrant, newer interest within the field of scholars who want to study like mediatized discourse, right, or popular culture. And in those contexts, you really can't just look at linguistic form, right? You really have to look at like the media platform, mm-hmm. Kind of look at who are all the other actors in play. So yeah, so I think it's encouraging, I would say, to see like scholarship happening now.
When you talk about body and adornments, like, can you tell us what all of that is? Because I assume it's quite a vast array of things.
Sure, yeah. I guess so, by bodily adornment, it's not like, I don't think it's a phrase that I coin or anything. It's just like something I use probably in passing in the paper. But we might think of it as like visual styles, perhaps, you know, that encompasses everything from like accessory choice to, you know, what we would call fashion, you know, what is the person actually wearing, to the way that their hair is, fashioned or whatever. So it could be like embodied adornments is what I mean by that.
So the bodily adornments, considering those plus the linguistic features, is this disrupting some sort of stereotype of femininity in South Korea?
I say in the paper that, you know, this artist's performance, you know, provides sort of one alternative form of doing femininity, right? What I'm not trying to say in the paper is that, you know, the appropriation of the bad bitch persona is somehow like inherently liberatory or feminist, you know, in a way that, doesn't currently exist in South Korea, right? Like that is certainly not true. Like there are many forms of femininities, different ways of performing femininity, I would say, in the South Korean context. But I do think that, you know, my argument was that it does reproduce, I think, reductive forms of like racial, Black and brown specifically, femininities, mm-hmm. by sort of selectively borrowing these markers to then bolster up your own, you know, femininity, right? Your own version.
It's not like you're giving back at all when you take these things. You're doing it to create something for yourself, an identity for yourself.
Right. And to be clear, you know, like with K-pop artists, like, as I mentioned before, like, I don't think the responsibility of like representation, or like ethical choices, right, and putting those in air quotes, should fall squarely on the shoulders of K-pop artists, right? Because there's a whole machine behind them, right? But I do think that K-pop as an industry is not out to produce some sort of like authenticity, you know, like it's not to fashion like authentic meanings or, you know, experiences. That's not really like authenticity is not something that is particularly like close, you know, or meaningful to the genre in a way that it might be for, say, a genre like hip hop. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as you know, I think the way that you phrased it, Megan, was like, is sort of out to gain. It absolutely is. Like the K-pop industry is out to commodify like as mm-hmm. much as possible. And that means not only of these like, you know, racialized forms, and the communities that racialized forms represent, but also like the K-pop artist themselves is also exploited, right? So that's also like a well-known fact of the industry. Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit, I saw that you did some work on this, about the linguistic appropriation that shows up in Ali Wong's Baby Cobra, which I believe is a Netflix special, right? Like a stand-up special?
Yes, she has two specials, actually. Yeah, Baby Cobra and Hard Knock Wife. And yeah, thanks for asking me this question. This is really, really fun to kind of pivot to that project, which is very new. This is a collaboration I'm doing with Kendra Calhoun, my colleague who's now at UCLA. Yeah.
Yeah, who's been on the show. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it's, again, one of these analyses that I think require more than just attention to language, right? Mm-hmm. Because we talk about how, you know, Ali Wong may use features that are canonically associated with African-American English, but we really have to look at what she's doing at a broader scale, right? So what's her body doing? You know, mm-hmm. what gestures is she making? What is she doing with her face? But also, and crucially, I think this is borrowed from, you know, Kendra's own work, like the genre of stand-up really has its own set of norms, right? And mm-hmm. And specifically, like, the stand-up comedian has to be sort of, can be over the top, but still has to sell this sense of authenticity. So in our preliminary analysis, we focus on her performance of what we call this sassy persona that is certainly legible and racialized as a form of like Black femininity. Mm-hmm. But when we consider Ali Wong's own race and gender, right, given that Asian Americans are popularly, you know, maybe raciolinguistically imagined as having, you know, accents or being language-less, right? So what does it mean for this like tiny pregnant Asian woman to perform that persona, right? So we tentatively argue that she performs this like stand-up persona that is raunchy, you know, takes no shit, and specifically Asian American type of femininity. So again, like, we're not saying that Ali Wong is this in real life. We're saying that that is the stand-up persona that she's performing.
Yeah, that really does come through in the stand-up. In the Hard Knock Wife, that was after and she wasn't pregnant. Or was it before and she wasn't pregnant?
It was she's pregnant twice, right? She was pregnant with her second baby.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So both times? Oh, I wonder if that's a purposeful choice by her.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. I think she's talked about it. I don't remember what she said about it, but I'm pretty sure she's talked about it.
Huh. Well, and I feel like that is kind of subverting some norms, too. I mean, women are often expected to fill some sort of role, and usually a little more I don't know. You're not out doing stand-up when you're about to, quote-unquote, burst or whatever, you know? I feel like that's subverting some norms, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think she plays with those norms pretty overtly, right? By, like, weaving them into her jokes. And and oftentimes, like, her jokes are aimed specifically at male stand-ups, you know, as well as white women, like, more broadly. So she does do a lot of that subverting through her jokes, I think, pretty overtly. Like she's very aware of, I think, what she's performing, you know?
Yeah.
So there's another Asian American who's also been accused of appropriation. I don't know if you have anything to say about it, and it's okay if you don't, but Awkwafina.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think with Awkwafina, I think she's criticized oftentimes because there's a couple of things. You know, her rise to fame was really through these viral hip hop videos, right? She's a rapper, and rap, hip hop in general, but rap specifically being, you know, associated with as a US Black cultural form, I think it sort of begs the question of, like, you know, those lines, I think, at least it at least brings into question, like, her own her own experience in doing rap. And I don't need to go into that, but that's, you know, certainly one argument that's and one form, one point of critique that's been that I've been privy to. And then there's also the question of her so-called accent, right? That is the critique, I think, has been that it's sort of a strategic one, that sometimes it appears, sometimes it disappears, you know, in the movie Farewell, for instance, which is a fantastic movie.
It is. I really loved it.
Yeah. So it was sort of like conspicuously not there, right? So it kind of begs the question of, like, who gets to perform particular kinds of linguistic features and when and for what benefit, right? So that, I think, has been a lot of the critique with her. And interestingly, like, in that in a talk that Kendra and I gave about Ali Wong, we mentioned specifically, like, because Ali Wong is sort of operating within the confines of stand-up, like, what is deemed appropriate might be a little bit more not malleable, but certainly the norms are different, right, within the context of this performance. So I think that's why we suggest that's why Ali Wong has not been sort of the subject of critique as much as someone like Awkwafina has.
That makes sense.
I mean, I would expect her not to have it, like, for her accent to change for that movie because it was a different role, whether it's her authentic accent or not. However, it does seem to be not authentic for other reasons.
No, 100%. And I think this begs sort of a broader question as well of, like, Asian American quote unquote language. Like, what is that? And I don't mean that in any, like, codified, like, let's take out the linguistic, identify the linguistic features sense. I mean, like, how are Asians in the US imagined or not imagined to possess language, right? And so when Asian Americans speak quote unquote standardized English, they're accused of speaking white, right? And when they are using, you know, African American language, they're accused of appropriation. So then what, you know, I think there's, like, it's a much more complex picture, but has to be contextualized by, like, histories of racialization.
Yes. Absolutely. How can we be conscientious consumers of media that may be viewed as appropriative?
You know, like, Megan, I really vibed with what you said earlier, which was that, you know, you like what you like sometimes, right? Like,
yeah.
Even if you're sort of judging yourself a little bit. Yeah. And listen, I'm the last person to, you know, police anyone's behavior, like, related to media consumption. But I think, like, I'm more invested in getting folks to move beyond these debates of, like, is this appropriation or not? You know, do we decide to cancel this artist or not? But I really think it's more about interrogating, like, the ideological work that these seemingly harmless performances actually can do, right? And I think for me, anyway, just for me personally, it becomes sort of increasingly difficult to unsee certain patterns, you know? And it really, that really affects my consumer choices. So I think in the case of K-pop, it's difficult because K-pop is such an emotional, affective experience. I mean, as is all music, but there, because of the fandom component, it can feel like really like an attack on K-pop fans. But I think at least interrogating, you know, sort of what is this industry? What are these representations and what are the effects of those representations? And then making those choices, you know, ultimately for yourself.
Now I feel well equipped. I feel well equipped now to like take your K-pop references or recommendations and then like go search for them and listen and like know what's happening. I feel like I'm going to be like a conscientious consumer.
Yeah, and you know, I think one of the things that I find most fun about studying popular culture is, you know, having these conversations with friends of like, you know, who are huge K-pop stans, like, what did you think? And oftentimes, you know, they're open to the critique. You know, they just want to hear like, what do you think? Like, what do you think from this perspective? Or what did you notice happening with the language over here? So I think those conversations hopefully can just open up, you know, more areas of like nuance and maybe attention paid to things that we didn't pay attention to before.
Totally. Yes. Open up to nuance. I love it.
Yeah. It's okay to like things that even have problematic elements. Yeah. As long as you're aware. Yeah. I think that's just like, that's always what we're talking about too. It's just like, be aware. Yeah. Of, like,
yeah. And you know, it's funny because a lot of my friends, I think, especially after when this article was sort of being written and revised, I think they were like nervous to tell me that they were like interested in BTS or like they were interested in you know, getting into these different fandoms. But I try to remind folks, like, it's really not about behavior management. I would say it's really about like, again, like having to have these conversations that at least take into consideration these broader forces and perspectives, and as I said, like the different ideological work that's happening, not just like, do I say yes or no to, you know, this artist or the song, things like that.
Absolutely. Awesome. This was such a lovely conversation, and listeners don't know that we had a bit of technical difficulties before.
Oh my god, yeah.
You were worried. No worries necessary, because this was an amazing convo.
Yeah, just because sometimes things go wrong doesn't mean that it's going to go wrong.
Right. Otherwise, like, podcasting wouldn't exist. It would just have ceased to exist if we were just, like, the perfect
literally
circumstances.
All forms of culture have existed, like, stopped.
Oh, well, anyway. Congratulations on recently filing Dr. Joy.
Yay!
Oh my god. Thank you so much. It was really nice to meet both of you.
Yeah, I mean, really
meet,
nice you, meet you, Carrie. Too.
Yeah. And of course, we leave our listeners with a final message.
Don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole.
Even about other people's cultural, like, what they like to listen to or watch or whatever.
Musical choices.
Exactly. Yes. Be nuanced.
Let them enjoy. So for this month, we would like to thank John H. Tice,
I think. Yay, John!
Mary Shapiro.
Mary! Hi! Thank you!
Yeah, Mary had Megan come and teach a one-week course at Truman State.
Yes, that's why I was tweeting from Missouri.
And Maria Hearing.
Thank you! I'm so grateful for all of you.
Yeah, thank you. And just as a reminder, you can join us at patreon.com/vocalfriespod. And we have different tiers, including one where you can get a mug. And there's a picture on Twitter.
Yes.
And you get all the bonus episodes and a sticker. And there's different tiers where you get different things. So.
And pretty soon, there will be a special Patreon bonus of a recording of one of our episodes.
Oh, yes. Yeah, what do we want to say about that? Do we want to give a hint?
Yeah, what's the hint?
I don't know. What's like something obscure enough that would sort of give it away if you really, like a deep cut? Is there anything like that? I can't think of anything.
I would just say, if you like Welcome to Night Vale, it might be particularly interesting to you.
Right.
I think that doesn't give it away, but it could be intriguing. Yeah. Of a hint.
I think that's a good hint, because honestly, I didn't know that there was a connection there until you brought it up.
Yeah, and I think a lot of nerds, hi Elise, know that that's connection right away, so.
Oh, yeah, perfect.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com, and our website is vocalfriespod.com.